I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. 2 years ago, the CIA believed that a Jordanian doctor named Humam Khalil al-Balawi was a golden source, an informant who had key information about al-Qaeda's senior leadership. On December 30, 2009, CIA agents and others welcomed the physician to a remote base in Khost, Afghanistan for their first face-to-face meeting. They'd even baked him a cake. Instead, things went terribly wrong. Al-Balawi was working for al-Qaeda and blew himself up, killing 7 CIA agents, a Jordanian intelligence officer, an Afghan driver, and himself. It was the deadliest attack on the U.S. intelligence agency in decades. Our guest, Joby Warrick, has written a book about how a suicide bomber was able to trick the CIA, and it's called The Triple Agent. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, writes about the intelligence community for the Washington Post National Desk, and joins us from the studio of the Washington Post. And Joby Warrick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Well, thanks very much. Nice to be with you, and I'm glad you didn't get swept away over the weekend.
No, I didn't, and I hope you didn't either. This book, though, I have to say, swept me away. And let me just roll back the clock, as you actually do in the beginning of the book, back to 2007, 2008. This is the Bush administration and the CIA. How did they view al-Qaeda at that time?
It was a very difficult time, because as you remember, this is before the drone strikes really took off in earnest, and there was a period when Al-Qaeda was beginning to reorganize and regroup, and the CIA could see things going on. They could see meetings taking place. They could see plans starting to develop, recruits coming and going, some of them Europeans, Westerners who could get into the United States, into Western Europe with visas and passports. So it was an alarming time, and a decision was made in late 2008, we really have to strike these guys where they live. And so permission was given by the White House to start this very aggressive program of using these remote control planes, these drones, to hit al-Qaeda wherever they could be found inside the sovereign territory of Pakistan. And so this is the backdrop in which things are beginning to happen when our story takes place.
Well, and you describe just how remote that control can be on these predator strikes. Describe that for our listeners.
You know, we see some of this in news reports. We get the sense that these are very sophisticated systems. They can take out targets at great distances. But it's incredibly impressive when you really get to look at it and understand it and talk to people who run it. Essentially, the controls are way back here in the United States, in the Washington area. The targets are thousands of miles away in the Pakistani tribal area. And a couple of people with joysticks and computers and monitors and sensors can take out objects around the world that are very small, that are moving fast, that are inside dark alleys. They can hit things in the middle of the night, in complete darkness, and they can even change their mind. They can launch a missile and decide, oh, somebody's in the way, let's ditch this one, and they can do that in mid-flight. So the capability is extraordinary, and it's something that we've been good at for a long time. We're getting much better at it.
But interestingly, and in a sense perversely, al-Qaeda has used these drone strikes as a recruiting tool.
Exactly. There are Taliban officials and al-Qaeda leaders that say, you know, bring this on. Every time there's an explosion in one of these Pakistani villages, one person, 2 people, 10 people are killed, we multiply the number of recruits that come to us.
Well, let's talk about this physician. And again, when we meet him in the book, he's actually being arrested. But let's talk about his work as a physician in Jordan. What kind of a doctor was he?
He's a pediatrician who works in a UN refugee clinic. He's Palestinian by background, grew up mostly in Jordan and somewhat in Kuwait when his family lived abroad for a while. But he's a very smart young man who goes to college abroad in Turkey, gets a medical degree, decides instead of working in a hospital or having some nice cushy clinic that he's going to work taking care of refugee mothers and children. So there's a very small, dilapidated UN clinic in one of these Palestinian refugee areas, and this is where he goes every day. And it's important to him because he's not just delivering this medical service that's close to his heart, but he's taking care of what he sees as his own people, the Palestinians, and he's sort of taking on their grievances and their complaints and their problems. And this is part of what begins to churn in his mind. He's very angry. He's angry about what happened to the Palestinians, angry about the state of Israel, angry about the Western countries that support Israel. This is the beginning of a period that makes him quite agitated and wanting to do something to strike out in some way.
In fact, he comes as you becomes, as you describe, a cyber warrior for Islam. He has a different identity that he uses on the internet to send out these anti-American messages.
Right. So here's a man who's got no criminal background, no ties to terrorist groups, but he's angry. He wants to express himself in some way. So he develops this fake personality, goes on the web, and begins to write for these jihadist websites. And he's writing not just, commenting in a sort of a random way. He's doing it regularly, and he starts to get noticed. People think he's a really good writer, even though they don't know who he really is. And the next thing you know, he's becoming a celebrity in the jihadist blogosphere. He's writing, diatribes about Americans in Iraq. He's writing about, abuses of Palestinians and attacks on refugees in Gaza. And he's, people around the world are tuning in to see what he has to say because he's quite colorful. He's a competent writer, and he has quite a following. And this is what makes him a problem, because suddenly there's this unknown person who's inciting people to violent things, and the Jordanian intelligence service, among others, want to find out who this is and stop him.
Well, even his family doesn't know about this other identity that he has.
Yeah, he manages to keep it quite hidden just for his own protection and that of his family, because once he's found out, it's big problems. He could the Jordanians could take away his medical license. They could cause problems for his family, take away their passports. So he does this all in secret until one day he's caught, and then everything changes.
Well, and he's caught and taken in for interrogation by Jordanian intelligence. How long do they hold him?
A very short period of time. This is someone he's picked up in January of 2009. They take him into their interrogation center, which, if I can set it up a little bit, is
this,
yeah, horrible place where you never want to go, where no Jordanian ever wants to go. It's the nickname for the place is the Fingernail Factory. Ooh. Which conjures up these images of torture and abuse and screams. And it's very true that the place had that reputation. For Balawi, however, being this relatively soft guy who's working as a doctor who's never been in trouble before, he gets into this place. They blindfold him. They deprive him of sleep. And within a couple of days, he's completely broken down, and he's saying, "I'll tell you whatever you want to know." So he's telling names of people that he met online, telling how the jihadist internet works as far as he can see it, and he's becoming very cooperative. And his handlers, or people who captured him, are sitting back and looking at him and thinking, we've got a new helper potentially here. Let's see what he can do for us.
He describes, though, being not tortured or have his fingernails removed, but being humiliated. Do you think in that he was radicalized in any way by being shamed or humiliated?
Yes, if you think about it, and when he goes back home, he tells his family that he was not tortured. He's, they roughed me up a little bit, but his biggest complaint is they humiliated me. Mm. So here's someone who's an angry young man to begin with. He's feeling guilty because he's writing these things on the internet, but he's not really doing anything. He's not going out and fighting, for jihad. And so he's now at a state where he's back home and he's feeling, emotionally, spiritually crushed because his enemy, as he's seen it, has captured him and they defeated him. So now he's more than ever trying to find some way to strike back.
Now, he is, in a sense, and I'm using quotations here, befriended by a Jordanian intelligence officer who begins to work with al-Balawi. First of all, describe that officer for us and help us understand what this relationship was about.
So into the scene walks this man who is quite exceptional by Jordanian standards. He's an intelligence officer and a very good one, but he also happens to be royalty. He's a cousin to the king of Jordan, King Abdullah II. And he becomes, just by happenstance, the case officer, for lack of a better word, for Balawi. And he decides to make this man his charge, and his challenge is to try to turn this man, this jihadist author, into someone who can be useful for the Jordanians. They've got all kinds of problems. They've got Al-Qaeda, potentially Hezbollah, Hamas, lots of bad people coming and going. They'd like to be able to use this young doctor as a source. And so this long courtship begins in which Balawi is taken out to dinners and coffees, and they begin to probe and push, what can you do for us? Who can you help us get close to? And so there's this brainstorming that goes on in the early spring of 2009 to try to match this man up to a job that could potentially help Jordanians and others as well.
Is there any way to know whether Balawi was in a sense playing with Jordanian intelligence or truly wanted to work with them? Is there any way to know that now?
Well, if you trust his description of it, he had in mind the whole time to try to find some way to get back at them. It's hard to know his mind or his thoughts at the time. The Jordanians were certainly convinced that he was ready to go on their side. They made, you know, the usual logical arguments why this is good for you. And incidentally, you could make a lot of money, potentially great amounts of money, if you help us out. And so they began to make these offers and try to befriend him, do things for him, take him out, buy things for him as gestures of goodwill and friendship. And he begins to say, sure, I can help you out. I might be able to do something actually extraordinary for you. I'm willing to go overseas to Pakistan and try to find the really big fish that you're looking for.
And so when does the CIA become interested in Balawi?
So once a decision is made that this man is going to be sent to Pakistan, which if you think about it, was unusual to say the least. He doesn't have any background in spying. He's not an agent in any sense that we would think of it. He doesn't even speak the language. He speaks Arabic and English. He doesn't speak Urdu or Pashto, the places where he's going to be going. But he's willing to go. He seems to be attracted by the money. And he has potential in the sense that he could, because of his medical ability, he could end up making introductions and getting to know people, maybe learning things around the periphery. So it seemed like an okay idea, maybe not a home run, but something worth trying. And once he's set up to go to Pakistan, then the CIA becomes interested because they need people in this part of the world. They don't have enough human sources who are able to potentially get inside the Taliban's tent or figure out what al-Qaeda might be doing. So they sign on as well. So by March 2009, this man has his passport and his visa. He's on his way to Pakistan under a pretense, and the Americans are now backing him. They're giving him travel money. They're working through the Jordanians to figure out what they can do with him. It's all very speculative. Nobody knows if it's going to work, but at this point, everybody's on board. Let's just see what Balawi can do.
We're almost up on our first break here, but obviously the CIA has spent years working with spies. Was this, at least as it stood in 2009, in March 2009, was this pretty much standard operating procedure for the CIA?
Well, if this, you think at the time, this is there's a change underway in Washington. There's a new administration that's come in. The new President Obama during the campaign has said, we're going to make a priority of finding bin Laden and killing him. The Bush administration had tried to do it. The Obama folks argue that they got sidetracked in Iraq. They sort of took their eye off the target. We're going to refocus our efforts on finding bin Laden. And so they were very happy to find anybody who could help in that cause, and Balawi was one of many who could potentially offer some help.
And that's Joby Warrick, our guest today on Radio Times, won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago, and he's the author of a new book, which we are talking about today on Radio Times, called The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
By the mid-70s, punk rockers were forcing established artists to prove their musical relevance. Neil Young's answer to this challenge stands as one of the greatest achievements in rock and roll. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week on Sound Opinions, we're getting out our scalpels and doing a classic album dissection of Neil Young's 1979 masterpiece, Rust Never Sleeps.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
When Hurricane Katrina touched down and the levees broke, flooding New Orleans, many wondered how the city would survive.
When you really look at the story of New Orleans, the biggest part of it is how we do celebrate through adversity.
A conversation with jazz musician Irvin Mayfield and music writer Keith Spira, author of Groove Interrupted, is next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. In late December 2009, a group of CIA officers, a Jordanian intelligence officers, and others waited at an American outpost in Khost, Afghanistan for the arrival of an informant who was considered to be a golden source. He reportedly knew the whereabouts of top al-Qaeda leaders, and he wanted to talk. Instead, he blew himself up, killing 10 people, including himself. And our guest, Joby Warrick, writes about the events leading up to that fateful day and the mistakes of made by the CIA and others. The book is called The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. Joby, there's so many moving parts in the story and obviously many players as well, but let's talk about this outpost in Khost, Afghanistan. Can you describe that for our listeners?
It's not the place you want to go for a vacation. This is
indeed.
It is probably the worst of the worst areas in Afghanistan in terms of violence. It's a harsh place to live. The Soviets, when they were trying to defeat the Mujahideen in the hills of eastern Pakistan, built a big air base there so they can run their helicopters and their plane sorties against these dug-in, entrenched jihadists, and at the time never managed to break their backs. This is a really tough and warlike area. And into the middle of this comes, in 2001 and 2002, a group of CIA operatives who decided to use this logistics area as a staging point for them, for collecting intelligence, for running informants, for doing the various things they need to do, and eventually becomes very important for targeting too, for finding, you know, sort of locking drones onto targets. It grew over the years. It becomes very fortified. You know, the people who live there rarely go outside because it's too dangerous, but it becomes the home for scores and sometimes hundreds, depending on the mission, of CIA officers and special forces people who are there doing these jobs that most of us never really hear about.
And at late, and obviously when this event happens, headed up by a CIA officer, a woman named Jennifer Lynn Matthews. Describe again for her listeners, I guess, what her credentials were and what she was doing there.
She's one of the most fascinating characters in this story. She's probably one of the best al-Qaeda experts that the CIA has. She's been working on al-Qaeda's case since before 9/11, she was one of the ones who were back at Langley arguing to the Bush administration, take these people seriously, they're coming to get us, this is a big problem, and was infuriated that nobody was paying attention. But she was started out as a reports officer, someone who gathered information and tried to generate intelligence reports that were shared with policymakers. But she'd never been in a war zone. And then this is a mid-career person or mid-40s looking to climb up the ladder. And by early 2009, she was looking for some place to go to try to complete this last step on her career ladder, which is to serve someplace in a, you know, high-level frontline CIA base. And so in September in 2009, she ends up in Khost. It's the first time she's worked overseas. She's never commanded a frontline station before, never worked with informants. But the CIA management loves her. She's very competent and qualified, and they're going to work with her very closely to make sure she doesn't make any mistakes. And so she drops into this narrative and becomes a key player in it all.
Well, and has a very hard-charging personality, would you say?
She is tough, and she rubs a lot of people the wrong way because she is very demanding, and she knows a lot, and she knows she knows a lot. And people who don't have as much information as she does, she tended to be not very patient with them. So a lot of the security people at the base took an instant disliking to her, thought she was, trying to run things that she didn't know anything about. And so they would have these fights back and forth on the base that continued for a period of weeks until finally this meeting took place.
Had she ever worked with informants before?
Not like this. She had been in, it's hard to say that she wasn't experienced because she'd done some very significant things. Because of her knowledge of al-Qaeda, when key al-Qaeda suspects were captured after 9/11, she was sent to some of these black sites, the CIA secret prisons that we hear about, and stood by the side of some of these people as they were interrogated. So she was used to looking at high-level al-Qaeda people and helping crack them, I guess is a good way to describe it. On the other hand, it's a completely different set of skills that are involved and needed to do something like running informants, you know, having people go across, you know, into the other side, to the enemy camp, then come back and then evaluate them, evaluate their information and see if they're telling you the truth or not. There are people who are very good at that. She was very new at that.
So across the border in Pakistan, we have this physician, Al-Balawi, and I guess part of his job was to convince what Americans, his Jordanian handler, that he was indeed working for them?
Yes, and if you think about him, from his point of view, he's kind of walking this tightrope between two groups that don't really know what to make of him, because the Al-Qaeda and the folks on the Taliban side aren't quite sure who he is either. He drops into their lap. He's offering to help them. He's saying he's sent here to spy for the CIA, but I'm really trying to help you. And there's a period of time where they're looking at him very carefully, too, trying to figure out if he might be, in fact, a spy for the CIA. And in the meantime, he's beginning to deliver very important, very strikingly accurate and helpful intelligence reports to the CIA. And so over the summer of 2009, going into the fall, he goes from being this untested, untried, possible informant to becoming one of the best people out there in terms of the quality of the stuff he was producing.
And he was able to direct some of those drone strikes, yes?
He was able to give real-time intelligence about what was going on in the tribal area. So when there was a drone strike, he was quickly on the scene because he was a doctor. He was often called upon to help out. So he would get back to the CIA and to the Jordanian handlers and say, okay, you've hit this target. This is who you killed. This is who got away. This is where they're moving to next. So he wasn't so much putting X's on people's backs as giving them real-time intelligence feeds about how the drone strikes were working. And it was stuff that the CIA could quickly check out because they had their own assets. They had drones flying over these places, and they could tell that he was telling the truth and he really was having the access that he was saying that he had.
So this was with the knowledge of Al-Qaeda leadership and Taliban leadership?
Yes, and eventually, as they began to trust him, they began to test this out. Is this really working? Is the information getting back to the CIA? And clearly it was, because there was a feedback loop between the things that Bali was telling the CIA and the CIA's response. So he clearly had an open channel to Langley.
Would you say then they were tricking the CIA at their own game?
They were beginning to see a potential here. And it's something that I don't think anybody really anticipated, the degree to which the Al-Qaeda, living thousands of miles in what we think of as caves and very backward places, were beginning to see a way that they could use our own methods, our own operational tactics against us and to flip them around. So they started to do some brainstorming in late 2009 to figure out a way that they could lure the CIA into a trap using its own methods and techniques.
Including video that he would then send to the CIA that they had set up.
Including video. And this is one of the most striking things that I learned, the quality of the things that Balawi was sending to the CIA to prove his credentials. One of the most striking was videotape, which he had. So this is the kind of low quality cell phone videos that you would take. He was having pictures made that showed himself with senior Al-Qaeda leaders sitting or almost eavesdropping on routine meetings that they were having. And then he would email them back to his handler, his Jordanian handler, which he would then pass them on to the CIA. And so everyone was becoming very excited because it was patently clear that his access to Al-Qaeda was extraordinary. He was getting up to very top levels of the organization, and he had photographic proof that he was doing it.
And I guess the icing on the cake was when he told the CIA that he had a new patient, a man named Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was, what, number two in Al-Qaeda at that time?
At the time, number two, and now number one. This is the thing that really excited everybody, and the excitement went all the way up, not just to Langley, but to the White House, because, as you know, up until May of 2000 of this year, we hadn't gotten anywhere close to bin Laden. We'd tried to get Zawahiri a few times. It never succeeded. And here was an opportunity to get this man who was behind 9/11, and they had an agent in place who could lead them right to his door. And so the excitement was palpable. And everybody all the way up to the White House was starting to get spun up. This is something we're about to do. And the excitement was just insurmountable.
And that's Joby Warrick. We're talking about his new book called The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, joins us from their studio, and we are talking about the fateful events that led up to December, late December 2009, when it turned out, seven CIA agents, a Jordanian intelligence officer, an Afghan driver, and a spy who was working for Al-Qaeda blew himself up, a physician named Al-Balawi, and that's what this book is about, The Triple Agent. Also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joby, it's always, in hindsight, I guess, things can look too good to be true, but let me just quote a couple of things from your book. And the president, President Obama, gets a presidential daily brief about Balawi, and I'll just quote from what you write. The Jordanian seemed to trust him, but no American had ever met him. He had bombarded Islamic websites with violently anti-Western screeds, yet he had flipped after only 3 days of relatively light interrogation by the Mukhbarat. Nothing in his lifestyle suggested a fondness for material wealth, yet he seemed only too happy to risk his life and sell out his ideological brethren in exchange for U.S. greenbacks. And you go on for there. From there, I mean, as it turns out, I guess he was too good to be true. But why did these red flags not impede the U.S. mission?
There are two things that were going on. One was just the level of sheer excitement about what this man was doing. Was he a real informant? Was he qualified to do this? It almost became irrelevant because what he was providing was so good. It seemed that the CIA had really gotten lucky. They'd struck gold. They'd sent somebody almost on a whim into Pakistan to do this, you know, highly improbable job of trying to get inside Al-Qaeda, and lo and behold, it was working. He was clearly there. He was clearly getting good information, and it was an opportunity they'd been looking for a long time. So the excitement was just it was building and became extreme. So that's one issue, and the other was there were people that didn't trust him and weren't sure that he was who he said he was, or if he was just a con artist. Maybe he was just who knows if his information was correct or not. But they did all agree that they had to meet with him. Because when it became clear to people in Langley that no American had ever set eyes on this agent, it behooved all of them to try to at least set up a meeting where they can evaluate him, look him in the eye, you know, check him out to see if they thought he was lying, and then to see what they could do next with him. So this is what motivated in late December of 2009 this fateful meeting, bringing together this incredibly productive agent with American CIA officers for the first time.
And one of those CIA officers who had doubts about him was a guy named Darren Labonte.
Right.
What were his concerns?
Labonte was the counterpart of the Jordanian case officer. So there's a Jordanian who's the main handler, and Labonte comes in to be his sort of the American case officer for this case. He had never met Balawi either, but he was someone who'd been around, who'd worked in Afghanistan as a paramilitary officer, had been an Army Ranger, had worked with informants before, and he had a sense that maybe this wasn't quite right. At the very least, the CIA was rushing things a little bit and was sort of jumping to conclusions about Balawi before they had all the facts. And he began to argue that we need to at least slow things down a little bit, make sure we know what we're doing before we bring this man into our base. And there are others who raised flags too, including the Jordanians themselves, who raised the possibility that you might be walking into an ambush. So the warnings were that clear and that specific that you have to watch out for this man. He may not be exactly who he seems.
But the idea at this meeting in Khost, Afghanistan, was to meet this operative for the first time.
Right. And if you're looking from the mind of Jennifer Matthews, who's this brand new case officer or base chief in Afghanistan, who's been looking for bin Laden for 8 years, who sees an opportunity perhaps to try to finally get him, and also has the pressure coming from Langley, from the White House, everybody looking at this meeting as something that's very important. So you can see why someone like her would perhaps disregard or discount some of the warnings, because from her point of view, he was a trusted agent. The Jordanians had developed him, she thought. And no matter who he was, it was important to meet him. So take out all the stops. Let's find a way to get him into our base and have a conversation with him.
I do want to play a clip from a martyrdom video that he records, obviously, before his suicide attack. And this is where he is talking about his motivation, that it was revenge for a drone attack by the CIA that killed a Taliban leader. Let's listen.
This is a message to all Kafirin that we as Muslims, as Mujahideen, as Muhajirin and Ansar, we never forget our martyrs. We never forget our prisoners. And we will never forget Abiya Siddiqui and Sajda Rishawi. And our jihad, inshallah, will continue till we free our prisoners and till the word of Allah prevails.
He also talks about, this is my goal, to kill you and to kill your Jordanian partner. And he makes this video just, a couple of days before this attack. Who's the person in the video sitting next to him?
He makes several videos, and then this particular one, he's sitting next to the person who at the time was the leader of the Pakistani Taliban. His name is Haqqamullah Massoud. And the two of them together are declaring their intentions to strike back the CIA, to strike back at the Jordanians who they hate. And this is going to be revenge, really, for all the offenses in their mind committed by the CIA against them all these years, including the deaths of very senior al-Qaeda leaders. They were living at a time when the drone strikes were occurring every few days. The CIA was being very effective at getting top leaders, and so this was supposed to be a real attempt to strike back. This is revenge for all the things that the CIA was doing to them.
And this is obviously a video in English. He made videos in his own language as well.
Yeah, he did some Arabic videos, but I think his idea was that if these tapes got out to the outside world, he wanted them to have maximum impact, so he did them in English. And one of them is quite powerful, when she's saying to the CIA, we're coming for you. You can't just do these push-button things against us and think you can get away with it. We're going to find ways to get back at you unexpectedly, and that's exactly what they tried to do.
So he is driving towards his post in coast Afghanistan, and as you describe, the Americans and others waiting there for him are, in a sense, eager for his arrival, and they bake him a cake.
They figured out that he had just had a birthday. His birthday was December 25, and now it's December 30. There's a well-known tradition in the Arabic culture for hospitality. You have to show, graciousness towards your guest, and in particular to this guest, because they wanted to have him relaxed and feeling that he was among friends, and this is something you're doing for all of us, for all of mankind. So they wanted to make him feel comfortable and welcome. So they had this really unusual reception, because normally an informant would meet maybe with two or three people. Instead, there were 14 who gathered to meet with him, lined up outside a building where the interrogation or the debriefing was supposed to take place. And as he arrived, the cake has literally been baked, and it's being walked over to this meeting area.
Well, let's take another short break, and we'll pick up on that. Talking with Joby Warwick today on Radio Times, he writes about the intelligence community for the Washington Post National Desk. He won an Overseas Press Club of America's Bob Costadine Award in 2004 for some of his reporting. He also received a Pulitzer Prize as well. And he's written a new book called The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. And we are talking about events leading up to late December 2009, when this Al-Qaeda mole essentially blew himself up and killed a number of CIA agents at this outpost in coast Afghanistan. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKZ. Quiet Craft Interior, Adaptive HID Headlamps, and Blind Spot Information System are all available on this luxury car. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
On the next Fresh Air, bring your appetite for food and conversation. We begin a week of interviews about food and cooking with Chef Grant Achatz. He co-founded a Chicago restaurant famous for its avant-garde food. Achatz lost his sense of taste for a while after being diagnosed with tongue cancer. He's now in remission and has opened a new restaurant. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Author Patricia Nugent never intended her journal about caregiving for her terminally ill parents to become a book. Her entries about caring for and saying goodbye, seen through the eyes of a daughter, is really about a journey so many of us must take. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, sharing stories, including Nugent's, about the end of life of a loved one. Today at noon, here on WHYY.
Learn about home improvement from the experts at a reception and discussion with the hosts of Ask This Old House, Tuesday, August 30th, 6 to 8 p.m. at WHYY's Philadelphia studios. For more information and to register, whyy.org/member experience.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Joby Warrick, author of The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. The book recounts the lapses of judgment, analysis, and standard protocol that led to the bloody deaths of seven CIA operatives on December 30th, 2009 in Khost, Afghanistan. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Joby, if you could describe for us what transpired that day, and it was a violent explosion. He has a bomb vest on, obviously blowing himself up, but the devastation is extraordinary.
Yes, and it's also amazing that he managed to get into this base, a very secure place that nobody gets into. It's got multiple rings of walls and concertina wire. It's highly guarded. Manages to get into the base without being searched. And that's done because he has an Afghan escort, somebody that the CIA sent to pick him up. He gets to the base. The agency's worried about spies. They're worried that there might be Taliban informants lurking around the front of the base. There may be people looking through telescopes or binoculars. And they don't want him fumbling around with ID cards and being questioned and poked and prodded. So they let him into the base without being searched. He goes through another station without being searched, and then to a third. And so no one checks him, pats him down, looks at him for wires or anything else until he gets all the way into the CIA portion of the base where it's very limited, very restricted access. And once he's there, he's got not just your standard suicide bomb, because they knew this might be a really big deal.
Right.
He had a 30-pound munition on his chest, which had the military explosive, the C4, very powerful stuff, and tons of shrapnel, just the ball bearings, metal fragments that were designed to just to go in every direction and kill as many people as he possibly could. So this is how he shows up at the base on the day of the meeting.
And who was responsible for that lax security in the final analysis?
Well, it's in the typical case, and things are hardly typical in Afghanistan because the CIA is doing 50 things at once. They're supporting the war fighters. They're spread out more thinly than they ever have before. But in typical cases, an informant will meet with one or two Americans in a car, perhaps, or in some back alley, where he'll be. The first thing that'll happen is they'll make him, put his hands on the front of the car or something like that, and then just check him quickly, mostly for wires or for weapons, anything, because they don't know. If you've been out working undercover, there are no guarantees about what you're like when you come back in. You might have been threatened or, pressured, or someone's going to kill your family. So they have to assume that things have gone bad for this person. In this case, they wanted to make him feel welcome. They were looking to get him in and have him meet with as many people as quickly as he could. So all those usual precautions just went out the window.
And as you said, there were some who had doubts, if not doubts about him, but certainly had concerns about him. Were those doubts, concerns then dismissed?
They were sort of grudgingly dismissed, I suppose, because there were security people there, experts who had been former Green Berets, who'd been Navy SEALs, who knew what they were doing, who didn't like the risks that were being taken and spoke out about them. But in the end, the base chief is the person in charge. It was her decision ultimately to set up the meeting the way she did. And so it kind of came down to this decision that, the imperative is to not have him be seen by anybody else. We got to get him into our little compound, and then we'll search him. We'll search him once he gets all the way inside, which was, of course, too late.
And did Al-Qaeda, Taliban, did they see this as both a tactical victory, but a victory of public relations as well?
They did. In fact, they fought over who could claim the credit for this. The Taliban wanted to claim credit. Al-Qaeda core claimed credit for it. Everybody thought this was a terrific mission because it doesn't often happen that you can strike and kill CIA officers because they're usually inside these bases. The leadership is back in Washington. But here they had a chance to get into a CIA facility and kill seven Americans, which is the most casualties in any single incident since 1983. So they were elated. They were they bragged about it for months. They used it as a recruiting tool. This is a very big deal for them.
You also, though, write about al-Balawi's perhaps second thoughts. He questioned his decision to be a suicide bomber, and it looks like he was perhaps a reluctant suicide bomber.
Yeah, that's one of the striking things about the material for this book. It's often very hard to read the mind of a suicide bomber. Mm-hmm. But Balawi, being this educated person, being someone who's somewhat Western-oriented, approached this mission very logically. And he sat down and wrote on paper his thoughts about going into a suicide mission. He said, I've often wondered what people think about, well, I'm about to give the benefit to others because I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking. And so he talked about how he worried about the fact this might just be a waste. He might never get inside the base. Or if he blows himself up, that's the only thing he'll ever be able to do for jihad. This is the best way to use his talents. Mm. And he worried about his family and about his wife and his children and who would take care of him, his father who was elderly. And he went down this long list of things that troubled him. And yet he decided at the end that this was his lot. This is what Allah wanted him to do. And so he resigned himself to do it and just put his head down and went for it.
So you don't think he was forced to do it?
There's no indication that he was, because I think if he had been forced, he probably would have certainly had opportunities to, once he was in CIA custody, to say, look, I don't I've got this bomber on my chest, but I don't want to go through this. I'm on your side. Let's have a cup of tea and eat some cake. But instead, once he got out of his car and was in the presence of these officers, he began to chant the death prayer, God is great. Hit a detonator, and there was a massive explosion that killed or wounded everybody that was within eyesight of him.
And how many were wounded?
So there were seven killed at once.
Seven
two more
Americans,
died.
Yeah.
Seven, two. Well, the driver. So his driver and the Jordanian was killed immediately. Two of the Americans died in helicopters on the way to a hospital, including Jennifer Matthews, the base chief. And everybody else, the other five were wounded with some of them very, very life-threatening wounds. They managed to get attention in time and were saved.
What effect then on the CIA when this happened?
This was devastating because it's not just the loss of life, which for them was extreme. We hear about soldiers being killed all the time in Afghanistan. This doesn't happen in the CIA's world, and it certainly doesn't happen with so many people. So this was devastating in that sense. And also they lost a lot of institutional knowledge. They had some of their best al-Qaeda experts present that day. So that was very difficult to replace. And at the same time, this was not something that caused the CIA to shirk or to say, we're going to pull back or this is too risky. And they did quite the opposite, and the base was restaffed very quickly, and then they began this very intense campaign of striking back. The pace of drone strikes in the few weeks after the coast bombing was higher than anything that ever had taken place before or since.
Because what's interesting in reading your book is knowing that Osama bin Laden was killed a couple of months ago in Abbottabad in Pakistan. Was that mission going while all of this had happened in coast?
It was. The search for this courier, this person who had been going back and forth between, a Taliban and al-Qaeda delivering secret messages to bin Laden, they had known about this man for a very long time. They'd been trying to narrow down possibilities for who he could be and where he might be. And interestingly, some of the officers who were killed at Coast had worked on this mission as well. So they had been involved in this. And at the time, in late 2009, it wasn't clear at all that this was going to be a rewarding effort. It wasn't clear where this was going. A few months afterward, in May of 2010, the identity of the courier was finally established, and then, all hands on deck. The agency began looking to try to pinpoint the location of this person and hoping he could lead them right to bin Laden, which in fact he did. So there was a bit of a payback in a way for Coast with the death of bin Laden.
But it seems to me that the risks were even higher for the CIA and maybe even the Obama administration because of what had gone wrong in Coast.
Yeah, and you would think about that because this was also the mission against bin Laden and the mission to send SEAL teams into Abbottabad, that was very risky too. The CIA could not guarantee that bin Laden was even there. If he was there, there could have been helicopter crashes and officers killed. They may have failed. They could have had Pakistani soldiers and airplanes coming in and fighting Americans. There are all kinds of things that could have gone wrong. But despite the experiences of Coast and despite the myriad problems and challenges, they decided to go with it, go for that, mm-hmm. and it succeeded. It paid off.
But would you say that the CIA learned something from what happened in Coast and instituted some kind of reforms within the intelligence agency?
They did. And one thing they had to look at was this science of counterintelligence, which is the challenge of looking for spies or moles or for compromises within your network. And it's something we used to be quite good at in the Soviet days. We're always looking for double agents and moles and informants and leaks. And when you're fighting two wars at once and you've got hundreds of informants that come and go, most of them relatively minor, it's harder to look at individual informants and to try to vet them more carefully and see if they're who they say they are. In the case of Balawi, nobody looked very hard at him, and nobody really thought through the possibility that he might be a suicide bomber. So that's completely changed. Security procedures in Afghanistan have been tightened. So they have learned some lessons, but it's been a very painful one.
And how about al-Balawi's family? What happened to them?
They were at a loss in the beginning because they really didn't even know what happened to Balawi. He disappeared in March of 2009, said he was going to go to Turkey to take a medical exam. Next thing you know, they hear that he's in Pakistan. They don't really know what he's doing. They don't really hear from him. And then on December 30th, 2009, they get a call from Afghanistan from someone speaking in Arabic saying, congratulations, your son is a martyr. He's mm-hmm. struck a great blow against the CIA, against the Americans. And they've had a mix of mostly grieving because they feel that even though they're somewhat sympathetic to what Balawi was trying to do, they feel is a loss of a life. And they've suffered, and I've talked to several members of the family, and they'd greatly wish they could pull this thing back, and if they'd known what he was doing, they would have tried to stop him.
And that seems particularly true of his father.
His father was this wonderful man that I got to spend a good bit of time with. He was a professor, or worked as a schoolmaster. He was a learned man. You walk into his house, and he's got volumes and volumes of Arabic literature, and more of a scholar and a thinker, and he's uncomfortable and angry about what's happened to his people, the Palestinians. He wishes that the occupation in the territories was over, but he also thinks there has to be a peaceful way to do this through politics and through negotiation. And he's grieved as a father and also, I think, disappointed that his son decided to take this violent path.
Well, and as you write about his son, and again, just quoting from your book, instead of the files depicted a young man of extraordinary ability and achievement, Balawi came from a stable college-educated family with no hint of scandal. He was faithful to his wife, doted on his two young daughters. He had a do-gooder streak a mile wide, yet he showed no outward sign of religious fanaticism. And I think rightly or wrongly, we think of suicide bombers or terrorists as not having this kind of a biography.
Yes, and this is one of the lessons I think that I hope people get from this book is you can't generalize about who some of these people are that we've been fighting. It's not just the ignorant teenager who's being given a suicide bomb and told that he's going to have some eternal reward in the afterlife. Some of them are like Balawi. They're very intelligent. They're educated. They understand us. They understand the way we talk and we think. They know the things that are going to appeal to us. They could not. This I don't think you could have imagined a more effective way to lure the CIA into a trap than the way mm-hmm. they did it in 2009. So they're quite good and they're quite dedicated. There's this gap, I think, of intensity. Some people in our country are very happy to sacrifice for their country, but these people are willing to give their own lives without really thinking about it all that carefully.
Would you say they know us better than we know them?
They've definitely learned their lessons, and the CIA officers who reviewed this believe that that people who had spent time in Guantanamo and were later released were involved in coaching and helping the helping Al-Qaeda think about how to pull this off. They knew the kinds of things that would appeal to us, and they used them very effectively.
There was some news last week that Al-Qaeda's number two was killed in Pakistan, and he's a gentleman named Ayad al-Rahman, a Libyan national. Anything that you know about him from your reporting?
Very remarkably, he happens to be one of the Al-Qaeda figures that shows up in one of the videos that Balawi took in the summer of 2009. And so it's been for the CIA, this was a very gratifying strike, because not only was he a high-ranking Al-Qaeda officer who's been with bin Laden since the beginning, but he is someone who personally had a hand in directing this suicide mission. And it was even involved in what was essentially an Al-Qaeda video production, which they use their own studio, which they have, and their own video equipment to set up a phony video in which he appeared. And this was part of the trap that Al-Qaeda set for the CIA, and they fell for it.
Final question. What was it like for you to get CIA people to talk to you? Of course, it's a well-known, very private agency doing things that in many ways we don't know what they're doing.
After this event happened, it was upsetting to a lot of people. And there are a lot of journalists, of course, but also members of the agency that were questioning how this could have gone wrong. And I think what benefited me was being able to talk to former officers, for some of them quite senior, and current ones who were going through this process of just trying to sort it out themselves and sharing information. How could this have gone wrong? How did the security lapse so badly? Why did we trust this person? What did we even know about him to begin with? And so there was a period of months in which these questions were being asked out loud in meetings and also in private conversations that I would have. And the Jordanians, they've had to review this process too to figure out how it happened. And I think for me, the challenge was putting together all these bits of information from many different sources and then to try to weave it together as a mosaic that explained a very complicated narrative of how this suicide bombing took place.
Well, Joby Warrick, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. And again, congratulations on your book.
Greatly enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Us as well. And Joby Warrick's book is called The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. He writes about the intelligence community for the Washington Post's national desk. In fact, joined us from the studio of the Washington Post, and he has received a number of awards for his writing, including a Pulitzer Prize. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show.